Hey, Discos. Need a little more Disgraceland in your life? Just a touch to get you through? Yeah, me too. This is the podcast that comes after the podcast. Welcome to Disgraceland, the after party. Welcome to Disgraceland, the after party. This is our fifth little bonus episode. As most of you know, Disgraceland After Party is a newish, unscripted mini show that I started a couple months ago, and that I'm bringing to you off the cuff on a bi-weekly basis to help bridge the gap between Disgraceland episodes. For those of you who don't know, this little mini spin-off show is where I briefly discuss the most recent episodes of Disgraceland, Disgraceland subjects who are in the news, and share extra content, deleted scenes, and ideas for future episodes. I also answer the occasional email and provide context on music I'm listening to, books I'm reading, and other culture that I'm devouring at the moment, as this seems to be something people like to ask me. Jake, what are you listening to? What are you reading, watching? All that stuff. All right, let's get into it. Guys, thanks to everyone who downloaded and listened to the Cardi B episode. The response has been incredible. This episode is the biggest Disgraceland episode yet. It had the most downloads per day and is on track to surpass all other episodes in terms of total downloads. Obviously, people are interested in Cardi B. She's an incredibly compelling character and unlike any other artist on the pop landscape right now. She's divisive, over the top, funny, attractive, and undeniably talented. And if you haven't heard the Cardi B episode, here's a clip. She was unique with that big Bronx accent and quipped totally raw and totally authentic musings on most everything. And there was no faking it to make it. There was just, this is who I am. Later for you if you can't get with me. I'm going to make you laugh even if you hate on me vibe. And it was infectious. On Instagram, Cardi B turned herself into a meme machine, spitting out constant quotable one-liners that spoke to her specific sense of self and unique brand of feminism. I think us bad bitches is a gift from God. It doesn't matter where life takes me or what life gives me, I'ma be the way I am to the day I die. And if you don't like it, go die first, bitch. I don't care about anyone not liking me. You bitches barely like yourselves. And then my personal favorite. Yo, I wanna eat my own pussy. She created her own language, popularizing words like okur, meaning okay, regular degular schmegular, meaning girl next door, or you know, your basic bitch. Yow, meaning yeah, that's cool, but whatever. And shmoney, as in that's what I want, that M-O-N-E-Y, what it can't buy, I can't use, give me that shmoney. But once she popped on Instagram, the VH1 reality television show Love & Hip Hop came calling. And with her platform on Swole, her new manager suggested she rap on those videos she was posting. And once that attitude, humor, and accent was set to rhymes, a megastar was born. After guesting on various singles with bigger artists, releasing her own mixtape, Gangsta Bitch Music Volume 1, Cardi B signed with Atlantic Records. And in 2017, released her first single, Bodak Yellow. And her debut went to number one on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, making Cardi B the first female rapper to go number one since Lauryn Hill back in 1998. But another female rapper almost prevented it from happening. Nicki the Boss, aka Nicki the Ninja, aka the female Weezy, aka Nicki Minaj. Nicki Minaj had a thing for the most hated Cardi B. All right, that's Cardi B. Check out the episode if you haven't already, and shout out to everyone who picked up on the Raging Bull homage in this episode. Good years. When I announced I was doing an episode on Cardi B, I didn't understand the blowback from some listeners. Most seemed to center around the fact that a lot of folks didn't know who she was or didn't like her music, to which I thought, who cares? I'm interested in the stories of these artists, their crimes, their drama, not just their art. In fact, oftentimes I find myself more interested in artists I don't necessarily like musically because what usually happens after I complete an ample amount of research is the artist's appeal becomes apparent to me, even if their music isn't my thing. I start to get why people love them so much. When I don't like something, and when millions of other people do, I want to know why. What is it? What makes them so appealing to others? There has to be something there. My taste isn't absolute. It's just taste. It happened with Cardi B. It happened with other artists I've written about. And it most certainly happened with the Grateful Dead. The Dead, as many of you have already heard me talk about, was never my chosen cup of musical tea. I found their whole thing, the whole idea of the Deadhead, to be silly. That opinion is silly in itself because, as I came to learn, there are many different types of deadheads, just as there are many different phases of the Grateful Dead's history, each featuring highly dramatic episodes and, yes, great music. Music that was transcendent. Same as with Cardi B. When I announced I was doing a Grateful Dead episode, some listeners blew gaskets, hated the idea of a Dead episode, as if Disgraceland was meant to be just about classic rock or punk rock. It was never intended to be that. Of course, others loved the idea, but the reaction to these two subjects was way more intense and obvious than, say, a Slick Rick or Snoop or Johnny Paycheck episode. And the proof is in the pudding, in the numbers. Cardi B and the Grateful Dead episodes are the two most popular Disgraceland episodes by a long shot. It's not even close. More than Bob Marley, more than Jerry Lee Lewis, Motley Crue, Norwegian black metal, whatever. It just goes to show that if everyone likes what you're doing, then you're doing it wrong. For those of you who haven't yet checked out the Grateful Dead episode, here's a clip, possibly my favorite couple minutes of the entire Disgraceland series. Bent was death at his door. Owsley knew it. And Owsley could have sworn he saw Bent milling about the crowd of stoned heads earlier, which, if it was true, would have been entirely fucked up. Owsley was paranoid, spiraling. So he cued in on Jerry Garcia, who was spiraling himself, musically, in the best way possible. Through the opening riffs of Death Don't Have No Mercy, a foreboding blues dirge originally done by Reverend Gary Davis, the band had emerged from whatever far-out plane they were on previously and settled effortlessly under the dark star. You know, death don't have no mercy in this land. Come to your house. You know we don't take long. Look in bed this morning, children. Find that your mother's gone. I said death don't have no mercy in this land. Garcia was nearly whispering the lyrics. The rest of the band stirred menacingly beneath him. Garcia's guitar, every note, pitch perfect and pointed straight at Owsley's temple. Owsley could feel it. Garcia hit the second chorus, gave death his due, and then exploded into the guitar solo. The band rose up below him like a sea quake, whipping him into a tidal wave of sound. Owsley held on tight, scanned the room for a life preserver, found none, felt the pull of the acid undertow, tumbled over backward into some deep oceanic void, passed Freewheelin' Frank's spectral madness until he landed flat on his back, so hard that he got the wind knocked out of him. He gasped for air. His jaw ached like he'd been punched hard by someone who meant it. He could feel the cold floor on his cheek, his chin perched over his left shoulder. He blinked, opened his eyes. There, inches away from his nickel-sized pupils, black, shiny boots. He turned his head, looked up, and there he was. Death, staring down at him, in the form of Maximus Bentley Scottsdale III, a.k.a. Bent. Owsley closed his eyes and prayed for another tidal wave. All right, that's the Grateful Dead and Cardi B back at you in a flash. All right, it's July 11th. At the time of this recording, you'll be getting this episode into your ears on Tuesday, July 16th, meaning that the next episode you'll hear will be on the Rolling Stones and their time in exile on the French Riviera. It's got everything. Death, destruction, drug smuggling, Keith Richards, and Apex-era Anita Pallenberg running shit like a boss in a shoestring bikini. This is my third episode on the Rolling Stones, and I actually already have a fourth recorded on Altamont that I'll be releasing as part of Season 4. But this episode is my favorite Stones episode. It captures them at a truly unique period in time for the band. Mick and Keith were at odds. Mick was kind of checked out. Keith was kind of running the show. Graham Parsons was hanging around. And there was a large group of incredibly interesting characters in the band's orbit during the making of Exile on Main Street, a period when the Rolling Stones were actually fugitives, tax fugitives. Here's a clip. Mick Jagger was in the basement. The dank, dusty makeshift recording studio Keith had cobbled together to record their new album in. It was as dark down here as the debauchery upstairs in the living quarters. Mick wanted no part of what was going on up there. He was down here with Charlie, Bill, and the other Mick banging around in old blues that stank of desperation, hoping to inspire Keith to join them and get something down on tape. But the jam without Keith was obviously uninspired. And besides, Keith was obviously preoccupied. Johnny Braces had made the connection, finally. It's what Keith and Anita were waiting for. A connection to weight, serious dope, enough heroin to fuel Nelcott for a month at a time, $9,000 worth. The Corsicans had come through for Johnny, which was a relief. Had they not, Johnny would have been out serious bread and with little recourse. These Corsicans were a nasty lot, big and intimidating. They sweat Tropicana and their glands released a scent that could only be described as a mix of cheap cologne, hand-rolled tobacco, and feta cheese. Their gold chains and sweat-stained Dax summer suits screamed nouveau drug money, while the bulges along their waistbands screamed indiscriminate murder for hire. All right, that's the Rolling Stones and Exile coming at you next week on Tuesday, July 23rd. I think I'm going to try to do a Rolling Stones episode every season. Let me know if you have any ideas on what era / what drama you'd like to hear about. All right, back in a sec.
We'll be right back after this word.
And now, onto my favorite part of the show, what I'm listening to, what I'm watching, and what I'm reading, etc. I recently rewatched the 1992 indie film, Laws of Gravity. Have you seen this movie? If not, go to the internet right now, find it, and watch it. I believe it's available through Amazon Prime. The movie is incredible. It's a hard crime drama, totally unique, totally indie, totally 90s. It looks and feels very real, very John Cassavetes, very Scorsese Mean Streets. It was released right around the same time as Reservoir Dogs, another crime drama, but it has little in common with it. And don't get me wrong, Reservoir Dogs is great, but it's almost hyperfiction. It's almost a comic strip film version of what gangsters are like. Laws of Gravity is the opposite of Reservoir Dogs. It's hyper-real. I didn't grow up in Brooklyn in the 80s and 90s, but I knew these characters. Scammers, liars, thieves, bad men, dudes you meet at a party or on the road, and you intuitively know, oh, that dude's going to be dead or in jail in 5 years. The film was made by Nick Gomez, who directs a bunch of television now, and the cast features a young Edie Falco and a couple other Sopranos cast members from a few years before that show hit the air and changed television history forever. Anyway, I went back to Laws of Gravity because I remember a specific piece of slang that the characters use. The term is Mucka Ferguson. What it means, I have no idea, but it sounds beautiful coming out of their mouths, and I really want to use it in this Jimi Hendrix episode that I'm writing. Any of you New Yorkers listening out there may want to ask your Uncle Sal what Mucka Ferguson means and get back to me. I would greatly appreciate it. The internet has bupkis on the term. All right, what I'm reading. I'm reading James Ellroy's new beast of a book, This Storm, and I think I love it. I can't tell. The more Ellroy writes, the more Ellroy-y he gets. Which is to say that everything is super staccato, subjective, and self-referential. It's also incredibly hard-edged, a cop drama, like mostly all of his books. It's set in L.A. and revolves around this Dudley Smith character from L.A. Confidential, but back in the early days of World War II. Japanese internment, drug smuggling, and war profiteering. This Storm by James Ellroy. Check it out. I'm listening to Mink DeVille's first album, Cabretta, from 1977. Jesus Christ, where has this record been all of my life? It's the perfect mix of downtown 70s cool and soul music. It also sounds dangerous and romantic, like you might get laid or stabbed at any second. My kind of record. Mink DeVille, Cabretta. Check it out. All right, how about some listener feedback? This email is from James N., who writes, on the Cardi B episode, titanium poles in New York subway cars? No! As an aerospace fan, it made my eyes snap off of Excel and think, what the fuck, titanium? Other than that, keep up the good work. I love this shit. Thanks, James. Keep listening. More to come next. Okay, I'm reading about 1940s Los Angeles in the Ellroy book and heading to LA next week. So with that, my for real favorite part of the After Party episodes, me getting into some history here, feeling nostalgic for old time Hollywood. Anyone? I am. Let me take you back and read to you from Marilyn Monroe's personal phone book. Kurt S. Dietrich, 140 East 92nd Street, TR6-8935. Joe P. DiMaggio, 5030. Alzada Drive, La Mesa, California. Joe DiMaggio, San Francisco Restaurant, West 17596 Ordway 3-2266. Frank Sinatra, CR6-0032, Exchange CR4-6161, Essex Productions, 9229 Sunset Boulevard, CR4-9383, Arthur Miller, Roxbury, Connecticut, Hotel Chelsea, 22 West 23rd Street, Private, WA4-4467, Kermit and Francis Miller, 78 Barnyard Lane, Roslyn Heights, New York, 1-4255. Morton Miller, Goldmine Road, Roxbury, Connecticut, Elgin, 4-6102. Ear, nose, throat, Dr. Maurice Selleman, 9795, Wilshire Boulevard, CR1-5202.
Quit talking and start mixing.
Cut it!